KALW.
There are sort of these grassroots efforts to counter this narrative that all Oaklanders want Tao and Price to be recalled.
Some Oaklanders want their elected officials to be recalled, but others are pushing back.
There's no denying there's a public safety issue here in Oakland, but the consensus on how to deal with that public safety issue is still pretty murky.
An Oakland Side reporter shows us what's driving two high-profile recall campaigns. Then we hear how conspiracy theories are dividing families through the story of a mother and son.
He's seeing her embrace not only crazy things when he knows her to be a brilliant woman, he's also seeing her latch on to very hateful ideas.
Polarization and politics. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We start today in Alameda County, where an anti-recall movement is gaining momentum. Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao and District Attorney Pamela Price are both facing recalls this November. Oakland Side reporter Roslyn Romero has been following this story. KALW's Sunni Khalid spoke with her to learn more.
This campaign got started earlier this spring. The recall forces were able to get enough petitions, enough signatures certified that they had it placed on the ballot. And it seemed that the recall forces were essentially rolling to an easy victory. They were raising more money for their petition gathering. And now we're getting a little bit of pushback, and you did some reporting on that. So this is Oakland, so we have more than a difference of opinion, and we have grassroots forces who are organizing on behalf of Pamela Price. Tell us about what's going on.
Essentially, there is this grassroots coalition comprised of residents, political activists, nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and democratic clubs, mostly in Oakland, but throughout Alameda County, that are starting to organize a sort of pushback against all of the pro-recall campaigns. So there was this meeting last Saturday, and the title of that meeting was Respect Our Vote, No Recalls.
I've spoken with several of them on occasion, at least the grassroots folks, and they were basically angry about the violent crime rate and Pamela Price's approach to that. And of course, they had contentious personal meetings with Price. The crime rate has gone down, at least according to the figures. Violent crimes and property crimes have gone down, but they still seem very determined to get Price out. What are the pro-recall forces saying about this?
A lot of the pro-recall supporters are saying that even though, you know, Pamela Price and even Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao have only been in office since last January, really, that the things that they've done so far during their tenures has only served to endorse or condone more crime in the East Bay. So, of course, one of the cases that Pamela Price is pretty well known for is she actually decided to not establish like enhancements for the people involved in the Jasper Wu shooting. So Jasper Wu was this 23-month-old boy who was caught sort of in a freeway shooting in the Bay Area, and he died.
Downtown Oakland.
Yes, correct. And so a lot of what Pamela Price has sought to address as a progressive district attorney is, you know, kind of championing the fact that a lot of Black and brown youth have historically and systemically been the targets of over-policing, over-criminalization. And her campaign has really been trying to give these folks a second chance. You know, restorative justice is something that a lot of pro-recall supporters tend to kind of downplay a little bit, saying like, oh, you know, restorative justice doesn't really work. Because if you look at the way that crimes are being prosecuted or not being prosecuted, like what we're seeing with Pamela Price, that just serves to promote even more criminal activity. Of course, the numbers don't really say that. The recent statistics and reports from OPD indicate that homicides are actually down compared to the averages over the past 3 years. So there's a lot of debate. Of course, there's no denying there's a public safety issue here in Oakland, but the consensus on how to deal with that public safety issue is still pretty murky.
You talked about the fact that the anti-recall forces were trying to organize themselves because they are already being outspent. So what are they trying to do? And does this seem like it's going to be a much closer election than it did previously?
As far as I'm aware, the coalition has not established any political action committees or any streams for fundraising to counter all that money going into these recalls. However, during this meeting, the coalition did discuss a series of strategies that were aimed at countering that pro-recall narrative. So those strategies are hosting ballot parties so that neighbors, families, and friends can fill out ballots together, returning ballots early to demonstrate political unity early on, also making phone calls, knocking on doors, and just spreading the word. I noticed that after the meeting ended, one of the speakers, Pastor B.K. Woodson with the Bay Area Christian Connection, he sent out a follow-up email to all the attendees, and he announced that the coalition would be holding a second organizing meeting in the coming weeks. Still not sure when that will take place, but I'm expecting that to be announced very soon. But, you know, there are sort of these grassroots efforts to counter this narrative that all Oaklanders want Tao and Price to be recalled. And by the looks of it, it seems like they're just starting to get their feet under them. You know, we still have less than 75 days now until the election. So we'll see how that turns out.
That was KLW News editor Sunni Khalid speaking to reporter Roslyn Romero. She covers public safety for the Oakland side. Find all our election coverage at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Last week, we debuted a new KALW series, Book It with Angie Coiro. It's a show about books and authors rooted in California. This week, she talks to Jesselyn Cook, author of the new book, The Quiet Damage, QAnon and the Destruction of the American Family. It's about how conspiracy theories have sometimes divided families, with parents cut off from children, spouses living together in pained silence. Here's part one of Angie's conversation, and a warning, this story does include mention of suicide. Here's Angie.
Imagine Hillary Clinton is a lizard wearing a skin mask. She joins others in a secret cabal, drinking the blood and munching the innards of trafficked children. Vaccines are poison. Trump was sent by God. Most critically, the storm is coming, when wrong will be righted and those in the know will come out on top. Jesselyn Cook's new book, The Quiet Damage, drills down on this shadow world. She's been a senior reporter at Huffington Post, investigative technology reporter at NBC News, and now she's a 2025 Nieman Fellow at Harvard. First up, what is QAnon?
QAnon has evolved a lot since it emerged in the fringes of the internet in the fall of 2017. It started out as this very bizarre conspiracy theory that Donald Trump and a mysterious government insider known only as Q were working together to take on what was known as the deep state, this cabal of evil, awful elites, some of the richest and most powerful people among us, people we know and trust, celebrities, members of the royal family, government leaders, were supposedly all working together from the shadows to do very vile, awful things, including trafficking children, harvesting their blood, there's cannibalism, pedophilia, and even poisoning our crops and our skies with chemtrails. The conspiracy theory stitches in kind of every awful, bizarre thing you can imagine into one super conspiracy theory. And it started out as a very strange, almost laughable little nugget on the internet with very few followers, and it has ballooned in recent years into kind of a household name. And even in more recently, it has shed its branding and started to just blend into the mainstream kind of seamlessly and very alarmingly.
Who does this appeal to? Who is it out there who would listen to such, for lack of a better word, crazy things and say, yes, that makes sense to me?
It used to just be the kind of, I guess, stereotypical conspiracy theorists, the tinfoil hat kind, kind of, you know, people would imagine them as these basement-dwelling lunatics. And I think early on in the movement, maybe there was more of that. But nowadays, the people who are drawn to these ideas are really ordinary, sane, normal people, which is very shocking to a lot of folks. And that was something I tried to demystify in my book, trying to understand how someone ordinary could fall into something so ludicrous. And in my reporting, I spoke to hundreds of families all over the country. I profiled five, but there were people from all different walks of life, different races, different generations, different political leanings, even including some people who were formerly Bernie Sanders supporters. And it really is astounding how there's some element of QAnon that can appeal to so many different kinds of people.
Let's take one of the five families you profile in the book. One of them has a member of the family, the youngest son, who actually ends up here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And you watch him and his siblings all deal with this in their own way. The mother, her husband, unfortunately commits suicide. Then she's left on her own. She is isolated in the ranch where she is, which turns out to be problematic, and gradually gets more and more involved in QAnon. And all the sibs find different ways to deal with this. So first of all, let's talk about Emily. That's the mom. Talk about why she was vulnerable to this.
Emily has a lot of very valid reasons to be angry at the world. Life has been cruel to her. In some ways, she's led a very privileged life. She's wealthy. She's white. She's a lawyer. She's very educated. So not someone who you might typically think of as being prone to QAnon. But her family did go through this tragedy. As you mentioned, her husband took his own life. And after her children grew up and moved away, she lived by herself out in the country for many years. And she was very lonely. And she was kind of stewing in this anger that she had neglected to deal with for so long. She felt this deep betrayal by her spouse. And as she kind of stewed in her anger, she eventually started watching Fox News. And Fox News is a pipeline toward QAnon territory for a lot of people because it really feeds and plants this anger, I believe, that there's these powerful people who are working against your interests. QAnon is a much more extreme version, but you'll hear Fox News hosts talk a lot about the establishment, the elites, the people who, the powers that be. And when you are conditioned to feel like a victim of the establishment, it becomes a lot easier to buy into anti-establishment conspiracy theories. So on Fox News, she was hearing, you know, Obama is golfing away your tax dollars and they're coming for your guns. They're going to trample all over your rights. And that primed her for QAnon's more extreme versions. And it was just kind of like building blocks to getting her toward that territory. But QAnon, for her, it was a gradual process that she made her way into this belief system. And it was fueled in part by this unresolved anger she harbored for so long, and in part by isolation, which plays a large role for a lot of people, just loneliness and people spending a lot of time online and increasingly detached from reality.
It's interesting you bring up Fox News, and it's interesting that you bring up that she was a lawyer. This is someone who's obviously, she's capable of cognitive thinking. She's capable of critical thinking. And the second element that brings up is the different outlets of media, social media and traditional media, that play a role in this. Let's take a brief sidetrack from Emily and talk about the role of, for example, Facebook in all this.
What's so interesting about social media and very troubling about social media is that it makes it harder for us to have a shared reality because online we're all traversing different versions of reality and it feels like everyone is seeing the same stuff as we are. But you and I could both spend an hour on Facebook and come away with drastically different interpretations of what's going on in the world around us because social media algorithms are so effective at quietly pulling us into echo chambers where we see a lot of the same and we hear from a lot of people who reinforce our beliefs. And so if you're starting to stumble into anti-vaccination misinformation or other kinds of falsehoods, they're just going to be amplified and kind of shoved down your throat in a way when you're online because algorithms want to keep you, they want to hold your attention. That's how these free platforms make their money is they generate ad revenue based off your attention. And the way their algorithms are trained to do that is by showing you a lot more of the same increasingly extreme content. And for people like Emily and others, that can just be a pathway into QAnon territory.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about these entities, it's easy to say, well, that's immoral. How dare they do something like that? Because once you become aware that that's happening, as a commercial entity, you would think the moral thing to do is to stop feeding people like that. But they're in it to make the money. If you take someone who is vulnerable for whatever reason and you feed them a QAnon thing or a QAnon, what we call QAnon adjacent thing, there's no particular moral question as to whether they get more of it. It's a matter of, can we hold this person's eyeballs long enough to show them another ad?
Absolutely. And we have seen these tech platforms make some progress and take some action to kind of quell the spread of the most harmful conspiracy theories. But that's really only happened in response to public outrage and in response to journalism calling this out and calling attention to this issue. But at the end of the day, in a lot of cases, it feels like the damage is been done, even on platforms that have banned QAnon and have started banning these kinds of falsehoods. So many people got sucked so deep down the rabbit hole that we're still seeing the fallout of that. And on platforms like X, not like since it's been taken over by Elon Musk, conspiracy theories are not only welcome, but they're amplified. They're promoted artificially by these algorithms very aggressively. I see it almost immediately when I log on to X. It's just some of the wildest theories on the left and the right, honestly, are waiting for me the second I open it. And so it's become less of a mystery, I think, to understand how people get drawn into this when it's become so prolific.
Now that we've met some of the individuals, let's kind of zoom out a little bit and talk about how pervasive this is. I mean, how rare are these people?
The wild thing about QAnon is the statistics are as stunning as the falsehoods themselves. There's polling by the Nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute that shows about 1 in 5 Americans believe the core conspiracy theory, which is that the world is run by a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. And that's not to say that 20% of Americans believe in Q and are reading intel online, although Q has gone dark in recent years. It's not to say that 1 in 5 Americans would ever consider themselves a QAnon believer, but these ideas have been diluted and normalized. I mean, especially this idea about powerful people being pedophiles. This has gone from such a vile, extreme claim that would demand a great deal of evidence to call someone a pedophile to something that's thrown around very carelessly. I mean, when Donald Trump was campaigning against DeSantis, he implied that he was a pedophile. A lot of our elected leaders have implied that Joe Biden is a pedophile with zero evidence. And this is, we've seen it with Satanic Panic, and we've seen it become a lot more normalized since QAnon became as popular as it is over COVID. Extreme theories are now not so extreme. They're just something that we accept as normal. The Overton window has really shifted. And so the statistics are hard to even wrap your head around, but it's just conspiracy theories have become part of our political culture in a way that is deeply, deeply disturbing.
You know, and it seems to bring a lot of disparate groups together. I mean, there are the anti-vax people, And within the QAnon community, they believe that you're being injected with something that you don't know about, be it a microchip or be it a poison or whatever. And then you have the Christian nationalists, who are their own group, but there's a lot of overlap between the Christian nationalists and the QAnon believers. And what other groups are represented there? We got the anti-vaxxers, we got the Christian nationalists. Who else is in there?
It's kind of stunning to see how many different entry points there are into QAnon. I think health misinformation is a really big one, definitely anti-vax and other forms of wellness movements, even yoga. Like, I think there's a large group of people who they don't trust the medical establishment. And there are a lot of people who have been let down by our medical community. And so there's distrust that builds there and is weaponized and taken advantage of by people who fearmonger and distort and profit off of falsehoods. But, you know, even there's a contingent of former Bernie Sanders supporters who embrace QAnon ideology, which is hard to imagine because we're going from the left to the far right. But I have one character in the book who did this journey, and I chose her not as an outlier, but because it was something I was encountering to a surprising degree in my reporting, was these people who had jumped from Bernie to Q. And in this case, the character, I call her Alice, and Bernie Sanders, to her, was going to be the savior. He was going to be elected, and he was going to make the world a better place. He was going to stamp out corruption, topple this profits over people governance model, and bring about a better world for her son to grow up in. She so badly wanted that. And I think a lot of Bernie supporters did. And QAnon, in a weird way, also promises a better world. It goes about it in a very different way, but we hear about this great awakening, and the elites are going to be toppled, and the corruption is going to be stamped out, and there will be prosperity for all. And so for Alice and for other Bernie supporters, QAnon kind of gave some of their hope back to them after they lost. And so there are a lot of surprising entry points into QAnon, and what it comes down to is that what unites QAnon believers is not a genuine interest in truth and facts, despite claims they like to call themselves truth seekers. Conspiracy theories serve different needs for different people. And so I think that's why we see so many diverse routes into this way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned people being vulnerable to misinformation. They're also vulnerable in a very personal way. And that's, going back to Emily, that's what we see with her son, Adam. Adam is a highly sensitive fellow who takes it upon himself to pull Emily out of this. I'm going to find a way to convince her this doesn't make any sense, that she's doing damage, et cetera. And instead, we watch him get damaged. And is that emblematic? Is that common amongst these families where the person who's reaching for the drowning member gets pulled under themselves?
It is. And Adam's story in particular is very heartbreaking because he's lost one parent to suicide. He's lost another to QAnon, and he doesn't want to let go. He's so desperate. He doesn't want to be someone without any parents. So he kind of dives headfirst down the rabbit hole after his mother, desperate to pull her back out. And in his attempt to save her, his life really starts to unravel. It's so depressing to him. It's so painful. He's seeing her embrace not only crazy things when he knows her to be a brilliant woman, he's also seeing her latch on to very hateful ideas when he knows her to be kind and decent. And she's taught him to be socially progressive, and she's taught him to be a good person himself. And so seeing her wholly embrace these delusional, hateful conspiracy theories is extraordinarily painful for him. And in the process of trying to understand QAnon so he can try to talk her out of it, he's falling behind at work. He's spiraling into a gambling addiction. He is letting go of friendships. He's not taking care of himself. And this process of trying to bring her back drives him toward the edge of suicide as well. And it's not uncommon. And so many of these conversations I've had with families that have just completely fallen apart as a result of conspiracy theory obsession, you hear these stories. It's like trying to save someone who, it's almost like you're watching someone you love turn into a stranger. And in many cases, it becomes like trying to mourn someone who is still alive and who is texting you these crazy YouTube videos every day. And you have to just make a choice to either continue to try to pull them away or to move on from them.
That was KLW's Angie Coiro speaking with Jesselyn Cook, author of the book The Quiet Damage, QAnon and the Destruction of the American Family. Next week, helping someone you love escape the QAnon quicksand. And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. Recognizing Trans History Month is one thing, but getting the money to celebrate it is another.
So it just, we're in a little bit of a crisis here, and no one knows what we're going to be in a few months.
Following the Money, tomorrow morning at 11. Before we say goodbye, here's some music from a local band. This is San Francisco's Dog Water. They'll be playing at Bottom of the Hill tonight.
My mind is in a haze. I left a body in the drain. I swear I'll stop. Stop, stop. Right down the road, next to the swamp I call my home, all bets are off. I'm in the manhole and the sewer grate.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Hussein Khan, Arun Nair, Julia Haney, Nagar Ajayabi, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Johanna Miyake, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.